and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bills passed this weekend by the Tea Party Republican-dominated legislature in Texas, one that will allow students and faculty at public universities in Texas to carry concealed handguns into classrooms, and another that allows the open carry of firearms in the rest of the state. Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, joins us to discuss how he might deal with armed students who are angry at the grades he gave them, and the irony that these bills will come into effect exactly 50 years to the day after the nation's first mass shooting on campus, the 1966 massacre of 16 and the wounding of 32 at the University of Texas in Austin. Then we will speak with the co-author of a new report at the Washington Post, Fatal Police Shootings in 2015 Approaching 400 Nationwide, a report that led to the introduction of a bill in the Senate Tuesday by Senators Boxer and Booker, the Police Reporting and Information Data and Evidence Act. Stephen Rich, a database editor for the Investigations Unit at the Washington Post, who was a member of the reporting team awarded the Pulitzer Prize and who also won the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for Social Justice Reporting, joins us to discuss his alarming report that exposes the need for a national database on police shootings. Then finally, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges joins us to discuss his latest book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, a powerful call to action that investigates what social and psychological factors cause revolution and resistance and what it takes to be a rebel in modern times. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Prophetic Voices, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And in your state of Texas, lawmakers right there in Austin, where the University of Texas is, are passing a bill allowing concealed weapons to be carried on campuses of state universities. Private colleges are exempt or can exempt themselves, but this is going to be mandated by the state government that when you're teaching a class, all or some of the students out there are going to be packing guns. And it leads to my first question, which is, you know, if you're going to fail a student for bad grades, does that give you pause if you're going to make some student angry that you're not passing them?
Well, I doubt it will change my grading procedures very much, but it is a disturbing development. The Texas legislature concluded its session finally. Here in Texas, we're a biennial legislature. They only meet every other year, so we're freed from them for another couple of years. There's much rejoicing for that in Austin. But this bill is troubling. First of all, it's one of two gun bills this session. The other allowed open carry. So if you have a concealed carry permit in Texas, you can now also carry that gun openly, and you can carry it in a concealed fashion on public university campuses. The bill did give the universities a certain amount of leeway to designate some spaces as gun-free, but it made it clear it didn't expect the universities to allow, for instance, a whole dorm to be gun-free, only selected portions of this. Now, this is lunacy, but it's the kind of lunacy we've come to expect in the United States from states where not only conservatives, but the Tea Party conservatives, the radical right-wing reactionary conservatives are in charge. And that's, to some degree, the case in Texas. We have a split in the Texas legislature between run-of-the-mill right-wing conservatives and off-the-charts loony Tea Party right-wing conservatives, if you can imagine that.
Well, there are other states, of course, that have allowed the carrying of concealed weapons on public college campuses. They include Colorado, Idaho, Kansas, Mississippi, Oregon, Utah, and Wisconsin, which a number of those states surprised me, Oregon and Wisconsin in particular. So the lunacy is not entirely restricted to Texas.
No, but I like to think, as a transplanted Texan, we kind of lead the U.S. in this craziness. The question is, what effect will this really have? First of all, the campus carry bill is restricted to those, remember, who have a concealed carry permit, and you do have to be 21 years old for that. So most of the students on this and any other campus in the state are not going to be eligible. The question is, though, why? I actually, as a longtime professor here, don't think it's going to increase or decrease my sense of safety very much. I don't like the idea of more guns on campus. I don't like the idea of more guns anywhere. But it's really not, to me, the practical effect, but what it says about politics in this country and how relatively, I think it's fair to say, unimportant questions like whether or not you can carry a gun on campus really dominate the political conversation. And it might seem odd, but this was a major issue in Texas. This and the other open carry bill took up a lot of time and space. And the question, of course, is what aren't we dealing with in Texas? What we're not dealing with is the fact that on almost every measure of the health and well-being of our citizens, you know, things like infant mortality and access to good medical care and educational performance, on almost every measure, Texas ranks at the bottom. You know, we vie with Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, states like that for the bottom of the measures of how well people are doing here. Instead of committing to trying to correct those problems, the state legislature is obsessed with things like guns. And it tells you something about just how kind of wacky politics, as you point out, not just in Texas, but politics in this whole country are these days.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Now, the chancellor of your university, the University of Texas at Austin, is a former Navy SEAL, Admiral William McRaven, and he's come out very strongly against this concealed carry law. And by the way, does the open carry law transcend it? In other words, will you not just have students in your classroom with concealed weapons? Will you have them openly carrying them?
No, I think the way that these two bills work, you can openly carry a handgun in other places, but this bill does dictate the terms of having a handgun on the UT campus, and that's limited to concealed carry. I guess I'm supposed to feel safer because of that, but I'm not sure the difference is going to make much difference. You know, I said this isn't really, I think, a terribly concerning question, although we shouldn't trivialize it, because, of course, any time you increase the number of guns in any space, you increase the likelihood of a gun death. And we've had a couple of incidents in the last few years where, for instance, one day a student with mental stability problems was on campus with in this case, an AK-47. He was a threat and ended up only harming himself. He did kill himself. But in that moment, if there had been other students who had weapons on them, I would have been more disturbed by the possibility of those students firing than I would have felt safe because there were other students. So this does increase the likelihood of an accidental gun death, and I don't want to trivialize it. But again, it's the crazy politics of Texas these days that disturbs me even more.
But in terms of your chancellor, Admiral William McRaven, former Navy SEAL who directed the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. He was the head of U.S. Special Operations. He has got some real credentials, hasn't he? And he says he's a real gun enthusiast, but he thinks this law is a terrible idea.
Well, he does. And, you know, I don't want to sing the praises of our new chancellor, given that, from my point of view, he's a war criminal. But that aside, it's another interesting aspect that every university official, the university presidents, the university police departments, and the university chancellor all argued against this concealed carry law. What's also interesting is if you look at the open carry law that governs the rest of the state, again, police chiefs tended to be against that. And so this puts conservatives who tend to want to be on the side of law enforcement and the side of the military in open conflict with military and the law enforcement. That was an interesting aspect of this, and another example of how this Tea Party conservatism is, to some degree, a new breed of right-wing paranoia, right-wing reactionary politics. It goes against some of the traditional alliances that conservatives tend to form.
Well, it's just such a obvious and cruel irony that the University of Texas at Austin is where, back in on August the 1st, 1966, a sniper, Charles Whitman, fired at people and killed 16 people, mostly students. That was the first, I think, big national gun massacre. Perhaps there were many others in the past, but this certainly one was the first one that got a lot of national attention, particularly in terms of a campus shooting. And one of the great ironies is that these laws that we're talking about, that the Texas legislature are passing, and the governor, of course, will sign because he's a Tea Partier, they come into effect on August the 1st of 2016, exactly 50 years after Charles Whitman's massacre.
Yeah, the Whitman killings were, in fact, the first big campus incident and one of the first mass murders of any size in the U.S., 16 dead, 32 wounded. And it's something that we still live with here at UT. Whitman shot from the top of what we call the tower, the main building. And for a number of years, the observation deck on the tower was closed out of fear of people reenacting that. So Charles Whitman is a piece of UT history, but he's very much a living memory around here. And I think that the idea of more guns on campus for people who actually go to school here is probably not a happy thought. I should be clear, there is an alleged student group called Students for Concealed Carry, but I don't think they represent the average students. They're a very harsh libertarian kind of group.
They're a state affiliate of the National Rifle Association.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's ironic. It's actually kind of sad. UT Austin is a bit of a bubble in the state of Texas. It's a liberal-leaning university in a liberal-leaning town, one of the few in the state. But increasingly, you know, when people say, oh, well, at least you live in Austin, that's so idyllic. The politics of Texas are even swamping Austin and Travis County, traditional liberal Democrat strongholds. And I fear that this is, again, whether or not the effect of this concealed carry on campus law is going to be all that great, it's a harbinger of some very dangerous trends in this state and, as you're pointing out, in the whole country.
But it's based upon a peculiar paranoia which has no grounding in reality. And, of course, maybe that's the nature of paranoia, although there's the old joke, just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean that people are out to get you.
Well, I agree about the paranoia, and that's very deeply set in this Tea Party right-wing Republican crowd. You may recall that just a few weeks ago, there was a big dust-up in a small town outside of Austin because of plans that the U.S. military had for some pretty routine training operations. Now, again, I'm no big fan of the U.S. military, but the U.S. military does training, and some of those trainings go on in the United States. And the local Tea Party crowd, egged on by some of the conspiracy theorists around, were convinced that the U.S. military was planning to, you know, impose martial law, or at the very least, this was a dry run for how they would impose martial law someday.
Right, and take away the guns.
Right.
Jade Helm 15, right?
Jade Helm. And what was so interesting about that was not just that the local wingnuts took it up, but the governor, Greg Abbott, as you pointed out, a bit of a Tea Party figure himself, felt it necessary to assure the citizens of Texas that the Texas Guard would be out to monitor the U.S. military. So you have a governor mobilizing the state guard to monitor the U.S. military to make sure the U.S. military doesn't impose martial law in a small town in Texas. I mean, you know, I hate to think if somebody had said this 20 years ago, we would have, you know, laughed it off as a kind of script for a bad comedy or something like that. But here we are dealing with this, again, in Texas, but not always that unique to Texas, this kind of crazed right-wing politics. You know, traditional conservatives who represent the corporate world and are mostly interested in expanding the bottom line for the 1%, you know, they pose a threat. I don't want to, you know, minimize the danger of traditional right-wing politics. But this Tea Party, it's often called populist, although it is a kind of perverse kind of populism, if populism is in some way supposed to represent ordinary people. It's catching fire, and in a way that surprises me. To some degree, I think I always assumed this kind of hyper-paranoia was confined to a fairly small group of people in the United States, but we do see it expanding. Certainly some of my students come from towns and households where this is pretty much run-of-the-mill ideology. Very scary.
Well, it's sort of similar, the paranoia, though, similar to the absurdity of passing these anti-Sharia laws when there's no chance in...
Yeah.
There's absolutely no chance that Sharia... nobody's even talking about it, let alone the idea that somehow it could be imposed on the United States. But nevertheless, they preemptively pass these laws. Again, I'd like to find a study somewhere on the roots of this peculiar paranoia. I mean, I saw a news clip talking about the open carry of some guy in a supermarket with, you know, pushing his cart with an AK-47 over his shoulder, strapped across his shoulder. I thought, who the hell is, what are you so afraid of? You know, what kind of lunacy is it that you feel that you have to be armed with an assault rifle at all times? I mean, if our country is that dangerous to live in, who wants to live in it?
Now, yeah, I agree. And, of course, you know, we've been talking about handguns, but to point out that in the state of Texas and many other places, one can carry rifles, shotguns, and such things openly with no permit and no license at all. And that's true in Texas. And you do see that, people out with shotguns and rifles can also mean, you know, semi-automatic rifles, an AK-47, an AR-15. Now, are those, and it's primarily men who are carrying those, are those guys engaged in some hyper-macho display? Are they actually truly afraid? Are they doing it just to make a political point? Do they like to thumb their noses at the so-called liberal elites? You know, it's hard to psychoanalyze this. But I think you're right to identify this as part of a longer story of a kind of paranoia in the United States. Is that because we're an incredibly affluent society that's never really faced a tangible threat, protected by two oceans and nations on either side of us that are not a threat? You know, have we developed a kind of craziness that comes from always having too much and being too safe? You certainly don't see this kind of activity in Europe. Even with right-wing politics, nativist politics in Europe, you don't get this particular kind of craziness. I'm not competent as a historian to analyze it, but it is a peculiar fact of American politics, and it's not new, as you're pointing out, but it's in particularly intense these days, which may have to do with the, you know, the end of the American empire. Again, hard to pinpoint.
Well, maybe we should also have somebody do a study on whether the bigger your gun is, the smaller your penis is. I mean,
now that's one thesis I'm not going to endorse.
No.
I don't know who's going to do the measurements on that, but I'll leave that to you, Ian.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the co-author of the new report at the Washington Post, Fatal Police Shooting in 2015 Approaches 400 Nationwide.
I know my destiny. It's like the sun. You'll see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun.
Families in the students all confused and party. We've been through each mother's arms is murder. New absence in a mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. I'm standing where the gun was drawn. Overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. She'll shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Rich, the database editor for the Investigations Unit at The Washington Post, where he's worked on investigations involving the NSA, tax liens, civil forfeiture, cartels, and government oversight. He was a member of the reporting team awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for NSA revelations and won a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for Social Justice Reporting. He is the co-author of a new report at The Washington Post, Fatal Police Shootings in 2015, Approaching 400 Nationwide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Rich.
Thanks for having me.
And Stephen, it does appear to be something of a coincidence that Senator Barbara Boxer and Senator Cory Booker have introduced a bill on Tuesday in the Senate called Police Reporting of Information, Data and Evidence Act, the acronym being PRIDE. It looks like your reporting had, did it lead to this?
We believe so, considering that in their announcement of the bill, they specifically cited the Post report on Saturday as an impetus for wanting to collect more data. I mean, it's been an issue that's been out there for a long time, but we think that we may have finally provided the push that was needed.
So the bottom line is that there isn't any national data available on police shootings across the country.
The problem isn't that there is no data. The problem is that the best data out there is still really bad. So the FBI is tasked with collecting data from the 18,000 state and local departments, but since the reporting is voluntary for these departments, we tend to miss a lot in the data.
And what leverage would a bill like Senator Boxer's and Senator Cory Booker's have? Do the federal government, apart from the FBI or perhaps through the FBI, is there any leverage in order to get these 18,000 local police forces to do it? Presumably, they're often busy and overworked and understaffed. I take it federal dollars must be the leverage here.
That's what currently is the leverage for the voluntary reporting. If you report, you have access to a certain pool of federal dollars, but it's not necessary to report. So what this will do is it'll make it mandatory to report, and I don't think that it will affect any chances at additional federal dollars outside of what is currently available.
So how do you mandate something that's essentially a state and local responsibility?
That's a very good question. We are going to see if this if the law ends up passing. It'll be interesting to see how they convince all of these state and local police departments to report to it. I have absolutely no idea how that's going to happen.
So how did you and your co-author of this new report at the Washington Post, the Fatal Police Shootings in 2015, Approaching 400 Nationwide, Kimberly Kindy, how did you do essentially what hasn't been done before?
We pulled together information from news reports from around the country. We found sources online that we could use. We called state and local police agencies, some of the larger ones in the country, to sort of verify our numbers and find out what we were missing. So it took a lot of effort, and I should note that we have two fantastic researchers here at the Post, Julie Tate and Jen Jenkins, who did the majority of that work, helping us get the not only get the information down, but to make sure that everything that we're pulling in is accurate as these situations are reported in the media, because obviously the first report isn't always completely accurate.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Rich, who's the database editor for the Investigations Unit at The Washington Post, where he has worked on investigations involving the NSA, tax liens, civil forfeiture, cartels, and government oversight. He was a member of the reporting team awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for NSA revelations and won a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for Social Justice Reporting. He's the co-author of the new report at The Washington Post, Fatal Police Shootings in 2015, Approaching 400 Nationwide. So the fact that no such data has existed, essentially, till you and the Washington Post and the Guardian looked into this, and now two U.S. senators have asked for, they've introduced a bill to try and mandate this collection of national data. Where does the resistance come, short of what might well be, a predictable excuse that we're overworked and understaffed? Where does the resistance come from in terms of not reporting?
It's not clear where the resistance comes from. I'm not sure that anybody has tried to pass a law like this in the past. Most have believed that the FBI's data collection was good enough for the purposes that it was being used for. It's only in recent years that we've started to hear a little bit of an uproar that we need to collect more data. And so it will be interesting to see how this progresses through the Senate and potentially the House, as to what the opposition to that looks like.
So how did your methodology differ from the FBI's, assuming that the FBI's collection of data has been inadequate?
So we are looking through as many sources of information as we can, and trying to find as many as we can. I should note that we've already, the FBI's average number of police shootings per year over the past decade is 395 per year. We've already hit that number through 5 months. And so it's important to note that it's difficult that we can't say for certain that we're suddenly seeing a massive influx of these because the previous years of data aren't that good. But what the FBI sort of suffers from is the fact that they don't actively go out and seek or try and figure out what these numbers are. They rely solely on the reporting of the local and state departments.
But in terms of the figures of the victims being largely evenly matched between whites and minorities, apparently African Americans are 32% of the unarmed victims of police violence, while Latinos make up 25% and whites 15%. That's according to the Guardian report. So would you disagree with that?
So we actually found that among unarmed victims, two-thirds of them were either black or Hispanic. So we had pretty similar results.
Right. So in terms of the, again, going back to the FBI's methodology, do you know how they operate, how they come up with their figures?
They come up with their figures. State and local police departments have the opportunity every year to submit to what's called the Uniform Crime Report. And so they submit a bunch of information about crime under their jurisdiction, and one of those categories is these police shootings, which are in the data called justifiable homicides. And they collect it based on who submits to them. And so just because someone submits doesn't necessarily mean that they submit all of it, and vice versa. I mean, we found if you wanted to believe the numbers in there, then there had been no police shootings in the entire state of Florida over a decade, because basically none of them report.
And why is that, do you think?
Some states don't see it as necessary. Some states feel like they don't need the money. I mean, I think a lot of times it ends up being a department by department thing. It may be that they are they're overworked and they can't actually get them out.
And what's the statistics on the mentally ill being shot by police? Because, you know, obviously, particularly here in California, you know, after Governor Reagan passed a law sort of essentially emptying out the state mental institutions, there's a combination of homelessness and mental illness that's pretty evident, and it does take up a lot of police resources.
Yeah.
Did you find any statistics on people killed during police encounters who had mental illness?
Yeah. So by our count, a quarter of the victims in our universe were labeled either by police or by family members, mostly family members, as having some sort of mental illness.
So, in effect, are we asking our police to be psychiatrists? Is that where our society fails?
It's a very difficult thing. I mean, I think if you look at us as a society, we don't really know how to interact well with those who have mental illnesses, and it gets amplified in these situations with police officers. I mean, if somebody is coming at them with a gun or a knife, I mean, there's that split-second decision that happens, and it sort of ends up playing out that way.
And, of course, now there's a case up in Boston where the FBI and local police shot a man, and there's all kinds of arguments over the evidence, whether and how conclusive it is. But, again, this raises the question of video evidence, without which a lot of this stuff, we wouldn't even be talking about it. I think the case recently in South Carolina made that pretty clear. How do you factor in that, what has happened to have been recorded versus what has slipped under the cracks?
So as part of a different story that we did a couple months ago, we looked at thousands of these police shootings in an effort to try and determine how many officers get charged. And we found that 54 officers over a decade were charged with the crime. Many of those were acquitted or had charges dropped. And what we found there was one of the key things that usually helped in getting charges was there was a video available of the incident which contradicted the police. In a vast majority of these, there's no video and there's no witness, and so basically the determination for what happened is up to the police officer or officers who are on the scene.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners probably saw the video of the fellow in Oklahoma who was killed by a volunteer policeman, somebody that was a local insurance executive who apparently had donated to the local police force and was able to sort of ride along and as a regular sheriff, and a routine bust of somebody that was trafficking in arms ended up with this man being shot. And on the video, you hear the shooter, the business dressed and posing and being a policeman, essentially saying, you know, I'm sorry that my gun went off. But that ties in, doesn't it, to some of the statistics that you've come up in your Washington Post report, that Oklahoma, the rate of shootings in Oklahoma are, what, twice the national average?
Correct. So obviously, if you look at states like California, you're going to find a high number of police shootings. But when you normalize for the large population in that state, it ends up being around the national average. But a state like Oklahoma is actually well above that. There have been a lot of shootings across the state this year compared to how many people live there, and people are starting to see it as an issue.
And what's the factor in terms of citizens being armed? Because earlier on the program, we were talking with a professor at the University of Texas, and now the state of Texas is mandated or allowed students to carry concealed weapons on campuses, particularly on the University of Texas, where, of course, the first famous or infamous campus shooting took place about 50 years ago. So it's very much an issue about, you know, it's a number of states have allowed college kids and students to carry guns and concealed weapons at that. So there is a push to arm more citizens in this country, or at least allow them to carry concealed weapons. So is that a part of the mix? It's hard not to see it as such.
Well, so what we found is that the majority of victims here were carrying weapons, and the majority of them were carrying guns. And I think in the instant that these events are happening, it's difficult to know whether the person that these police officers are dealing with is a good guy with a gun or a bad guy with a gun. And so a lot of times they have to make judgment calls, and it can be very difficult, but they have to do it in such a short time span that I have to imagine that it definitely factors in a bit.
So in terms of the future, and you're going to be doing more work on it, but I take it we're on track for 1,000 deaths a year. That seems alarming, but what's the basis of that prediction?
So we pretty much just extrapolated out the shootings based on what it looked like through 5 months. And what I can say is, I mean, a lot of people have said that's alarming, but because there's no good data, really, from prior to this year, we have absolutely no idea whether that number is up or down from previous years. We plan to continue following this up in an ongoing series that we've been working on police accountability, probably through at least the end of the year. We have the intention of adding to our database through at least the end of the year as well. We intend to continue to collect every piece of information that we can get on this.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Rich, who is the database editor for the Investigations Unit at the Washington Post, where he's worked on investigations involving the NSA, tax liens, civil forfeiture, cartels, and government oversight. He was a member of the reporting team awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for NSA revelations and won the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for Social Justice Reporting. He's the co-author of the new report at the Washington Post, Fatal Police Shootings in 2015 Approaching 400 Nationwide. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges.
Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, because you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, because we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound.
And joining us now is Chris Hedges, who's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times, where in 2002 he was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights and is the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, and his latest book just out is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Ian.
And Chris, do you happen to have a copy of your book handy?
I do.
Oh, good. Would you mind, may seem like an odd request, but would you mind reading the first paragraph of the book?
We live in a revolutionary moment. The disastrous economic and political experiment that attempted to organize human behavior around the dictates of the global marketplace has failed. The promised prosperity that was to have raised the living standards of workers through trickle-down economics has been exposed as a lie. A tiny global oligarchy has amassed obscene wealth, while the engine of unfettered corporate capitalism plunders resources, exploits cheap, unorganized labor, and creates pliable, corrupt governments that abandon the common good to serve corporate profit. The relentless drive by the fossil fuel industry for profits is destroying the ecosystem, threatening the viability of the human species. And no mechanisms to institute genuine reform or halt the corporate assault are left within the structures of power, which have surrendered to corporate control. The citizen has become irrelevant. He or she can participate in heavily choreographed elections, but the demands of corporations and banks are paramount.
Well, there you have it. I think that's one of the most cogent, succinct, and powerful summaries of the predicament we face here global citizens on this endangered planet.
Well, good. That's the starting point.
Exactly.
and we have to go from there. I don't spend a lot of the book arguing that point. I have done that in past books.
No, I understand. And it's just like, you pose the situation and then you move right on to now what do we do? And that's what your new book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, is about. So And by the way, just to buttress the introduction, I was astounded, I'm sure you were, by the Oxfam report that found that only 85 families on this planet control the wealth equivalent to half of all humanity.
Right.
I mean, it's extraordinary how... And what do you think is the inexorable driver of that?
The driver behind the amassing of that kind of wealth?
Yeah, to the point of absurdity. I mean, here in the United States, we have one family, the Waltons, who are all heirs to the Walmart fortune, and their combined wealth is equal to that of the lower 40% of all American households.
Well, it's a sickness. I mean, and the more they get, the more they want. You know, there's never enough. I mean, I have to fall back on my divinity school training. It's a kind of idolatry, the building of monuments of power and wealth to yourself, but it's demented. And unfortunately, these people have complete control of not only the economic system, but the political system.
So what happened to it? It'd be easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven.
Well, we got the Christian right that started preaching that Jesus came to bring us all Cadillacs.
I see.
So it was the utter, and you know, this was done by design.
Right.
This fusion of corporate oligarchs with this utter perversion of the Christian religion. And I'm frankly, I have to blame the liberal church because these people got out and started preaching this garbage. And in the name of tolerance, they didn't say a word. You know, you don't have to spend 3 years at Harvard Divinity School, as I did, to understand that Jesus did not come to make us rich, nor would Jesus have blessed the dropping of iron fragmentation bombs on Muslims in the Middle East. These people are Christian heretics, and those people who were tasked with actually studying and ostensibly defending the gospel didn't say a word.
So let's turn to your new book in terms of what do we do, since you so eloquently in one paragraph essentially summarized our predicament here on this planet. In terms of the idea of that there is a sublime madness that guides the actions of rebels. Tell me about what the social and psychological factors that cause revolution and resistance, which you've investigated in your book. Obviously, the point being that there are no incremental or systemic programs out there to right the wrongs and to reverse or slow the trajectory we're on. It requires revolution. I take it that...
Right, and we're seeing repeated examples of how what the vast majority of the citizenry rejects and does not want becomes policy anyway, writ large. From you can start with the bank bailout, which constituent calls were 100-1 against that across the political spectrum in Congress, the Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. I sued the president over this act, which permits the military to carry out domestic policing, had a 97% disapproval rating. It's law. When nobody wants money in campaign, you know, corporations to essentially use money to replace the vote. People don't want wholesale surveillance. Even as we're watching now in Denton, Texas, a community rises up to protest the fracking that's going on in its midst, and the Texas Senate passes a bill that makes it illegal for local communities to determine what takes place within their midst. And this is dangerous because the corporate coup d'etat that's taken place as people begin to push back becomes more naked and unable to use propaganda anymore. The state increasingly uses very violent forms of coercion. We saw tanks on the streets of Ferguson against nonviolent protesters. And so we're in this period that Antonio Gramsci called the interregnum, where the old ideas have been discredited, the old ideas of neoliberalism, the idea that the dictates of the marketplace should rule every aspect of human behavior. But we have yet to formulate a vision of what will take it place. And Berkman, Alexander Berkman, in his essay, Invisible Revolution, writes that that period when the old ideas are discredited and people no longer, and of course, as Marx understood, whatever the ruling ideology is, it's built around the primacy of economic power. So as neoliberalism loses its efficacy, you see this, the facade remains, but you see this subterranean undercurrent of discontent, which I think is there. And then when it explodes, as Berkman writes, it's like a boiling tea kettle. You hear the whistle and you see the steam, but you've not witnessed that long process where the water is heated up in temperature. And I think that is exactly where we are. So we're watching nascent movements to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour, Black Lives Matter, debt jubilee, anti-fracking, and these are kind of brush fires against corporate power. And of course, the response of corporate power is to stomp them out. So if you look up at Seattle, where Shama Sawant, the socialist city councilwoman, is running for re-election, the national Democratic establishment, much as they did to Ralph Nader, is pumping massive resources into this small city council campaign to crush her because they're worried. And I think, unfortunately, they convinced Bernie Sanders that if he didn't run as a Democrat, he would lose his committee chairmanships and he would end up like Ralph Nader. And so we are essentially, and I, on many issues, I'm with Bernie, although not on Israel-Palestine, and he's not good about confronting the military-industrial complex. In fact, he doesn't confront it, and that's the most dangerous institution in America today. But he has to run as a Democrat to give lend legitimacy to a political party that is utterly captive to corporate money and corporate power. He's not going to be allowed on the debates unless he agrees to endorse the candidate who we're watching Hillary Clinton travel the country as if, you know, she's American royalty. And then in essence, what you do is what Van Jones did in the last election. You funnel energy and money and into a dead political entity. So we need to strike out from these institutions. We need to turn on all of them, including the Democratic Party. We need to name them for who they are. We need to regain the kind of militancy that characterized earlier radical movements in this country, the old socialists, the Communist Party, the anarchists, groups like the Wobblies, the old CIO, all of those groups that walked into Roosevelt's office and said, either you do something or you're going to end up like the Soviet Union. And they meant it. And Roosevelt said to the ruling class, of which he was, of course, a member, you better give up some of your money and make this work, or you may lose all of your money. That's how power works. And so Roosevelt creates a jobs program, puts 15 million Americans to work, Social Security. And we've got to regain that kind of power, which has been taken from us consciously by the capitalist state in the name of anti-communism, if we have any chance of fighting back.
Well, when you talk about the corporate state, then, my understanding is that corporate state wants us to be passive consumers and not active citizens, and to relegate politics to a kind of a political game show,
right,
which is pretty much what we have now.
Right.
If we, and our choice is to become active citizens, and that is enshrined in the Constitution, which, by the way, says that after it says, you know, the government deriving its just powers from the consent of the governed, it goes on to say, but if a government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to overthrow it and replace it. So the mechanism is built in, isn't it?
Verbally. The state is doing everything in its power to prevent that from happening, of course.
Right, but everybody swears their allegiance to the Constitution of the United States. And, I mean, it is a powerful, isn't it a good place to start? Let me put it that way.
It is. It's a great place to start. But I think at this point, you know, the most basic rights enshrined in the Constitution have been overturned by judicial fiat through reinterpretation, so that unlimited corporate cash in campaigns becomes the right to petition the government. I mean, this isn't the right to petition the government, of course. Over and over, we have seen the court strip us of our rights by reinterpreting them.
So corporations as persons in law get more and more rights, and real persons get less rights.
Yes, and corporations, of course, are never punished for criminal acts that they convict. I mean, they pay fines, but nobody ever goes to jail.
But for corporations to continue, how do they get around the conundrum people are not being paid enough
right.
to buy the products that they produce?
Then we have to go right to Karl Marx, because he understood the late stages of capitalism, where, as Marx wrote, capitalism begins to prey on the very superstructures that once sustained it. And that's precisely what we're seeing with globalization, where...
I think we also saw that in 2008, didn't we? Wasn't that...
There you go. There's a perfect example of how it works, where you essentially, capitalists become loan sharks, and they make money off of speculation. So they can't, because they can't generate profits at past levels, and they take it out increasingly upon the working class and the poor in the name of austerity, driving them deeper into debt, and of course slashing any kinds of programs that serve the needs of the citizenry, relocating the jobs to places like Bangladesh, or mechanizing them. And the response of that economic assault by corporate capitalists, not only on the working class but on the middle class, which is the bulwark of a capitalist system, is disguised by massive personal debt. And so you build this false economy on the scaffolding of debt peonage, and then, as we saw in the subprime mortgage crisis, there comes a moment, Marx wrote this, when there were no new markets available, there were no new pools of people to exploit, and everything comes down. And meanwhile, you have these oligarchs who are hoarding these tremendous sums of wealth. We have $18 trillion stashed in overseas tax havens. And so the final stage of capitalism is that it actually destroys the free market, as well as the values and traditions that it claims to defend. And it pillages those systems. It cannibalizes them. In this kind of frantic effort to sustain itself, but it's terminal. And that's what we're seeing at this moment. And I think people feel the effects of it, and they may not understand all of the, you know, the kind of detailed economic theory that Marx got that's behind it, but that's what's going on. It's not capitalism anymore. I mean, that's the kind of irony. The capitalists in the final stage destroy capitalism itself. And that's why they keep going after government money. So, we spend $1 trillion a year on national security. We're building, 12 Ohio-class nuclear submarines for $8 billion. This is the last House appropriations bills, $8 billion each. And all of this enriches corporations. We spend $100 billion a year on intelligence. 70% of that money goes to corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, which gets 99% of its revenues from the U.S. government. We haven't even talked about the fossil fuel industry, which eats up $5.3 trillion a year in worldwide hidden costs, so they can keep burning, this is according to the IMF, so they can keep burning fossil fuels, which is destroying the planet.
Well, we are the only advanced industrial state in the world that practices right-wing welfare. I mean, most
we
of the...
We do it, and that's what it is. It's socialism for corporations.
Right.
And look at the banks. I mean, there was a story in Bloomberg News called Why Should Taxpayers Give Big Banks $83 billion a Year, where they did a study. So they multiplied by the total liabilities of the largest U.S. banks this ability on the part of the banks to borrow at 0.08% interest. And they said that amounts to a taxpayer subsidy to the top five banks of $83 billion a year. And they said if you took away that subsidy, the banks, with the absence of this corporate welfare, the banks would break even. And that this money is essentially, which they report as profit, it are essentially government transfers from taxpayers to shareholders. That's Bloomberg News. That's hardly, the Socialist Weekly. So, you look closely and you see all of these indications where the corporations are disemboweling the very states that once sustained them. There was an editorial on the 22nd of May in the New York Times, which talked about Citigroup, Citicorp, JPMorgan Chase, Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland, which all pled guilty to criminal charges for rigging the value of the world's currency. And these banks were charged fines of $9 billion.
Tax deductible.
Between 2007 and 2013, the money they made from rigging the world's currencies was $85 billion. I mean, this is nuts, and it's almost daily now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.